Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids.
So welcome to the next edition of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Hillary Lockwood, and Hillary is a dear friend of mine. She owns Hilltop Yoga in Lansing, Michigan, and also in Chicago. And so Hillary, I really appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So let's just kind of get into it. So why don't you give us a little bit of background of who you are and, you know, like maybe a little bit before yoga so that we can kind of lead into that.
Sure. So I left home at about 18, 10 days after.
We're starting way back.
We are 10 days after I graduated high school. And it was my 18th birthday, and I went into some creepy old bookstore. And for whatever reason, the book that I chose was the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And, you know, I think you look at those moments in your life and you honestly have no idea why you do the things you do. I think I was just an angry 18-year-old that was searching for something beyond Christianity but still honoring, you know, the spirituality of my own soul. Does that make sense?
Of course, yeah.
So I ended up with this book, and, you know, it's super funny because you think about the cover of that book and I have the Satchitananda. So Satchitananda in his weird little pink bathrobe. And I mean, what a strange thing to grab. Anyways, so I picked up that book on my 18th birthday, and that was really the beginning of my journey. I stayed in my sutras for 3 years before I ever practiced asana.
So when you went to the bookstore, you actually grabbed Satchitananda's copy of it, the light blue one?
The light blue one. It's the book I still use today. Yeah. I've had it rebound twice. Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy.
It's crazy.
And so you didn't start your asana practice till a few years after that?
Yeah, because I was a competitive gymnast and a competitive dancer. I danced in LA at Debbie Reynolds' studio. And all I really knew in my body was competition. So I didn't want that piece in it. You know, I was reading this book and it was resonating with me. And the whole idea of non-competitive, non-comparative became really important. And I think it was more out of fear because all of my physical movement was so ego-based because it was competition-based. Yeah. So my first class was when I was 21 and it was at LA Fitness. And it was so bad. I ate like a giant meal because I ate like a giant meal before I went in.
Yeah. I mean, like what, a hamburger or something?
No, like a huge omelet. I ate like a big breakfast.
Okay.
And she had us in plow for what felt like, I don't know, an hour. And I really thought I was going to puke the whole time. But also there was just none of the, you know, there was none of the spirituality that I was reading in the book. And I'm thinking, well, this isn't the same thing. If that's yoga, then this isn't, right?
Right. How did you kind of like put that together in your head?
Well, because I'd been in the sutras for so long and I, you know, you recognize that there are only two sutras that mention asana at all. And really, it just mentions asana in the list of the eight limbs.
Right.
There's no speaking of, you know, physical postures, et cetera, et cetera. So my second class was with Mati, and I fell in love. I fell in love with her. I fell in love with the fact that it was all of the pieces put together. That's when the magic happened. That's when I decided to kind of stop everything else I was doing and just dive in full force. So
let me just kind of clarify some things. So you stopped your competitive dancing as soon as you kind of met Matthias Roddy?
I stopped everything else. I really did. I was an actress as well at the time in LA, and you can Google some really funny things actually that I'm in, but no, really, it's bad. So bad. But all of that went away. You know, I started to recognize the selfishness in a lot of these choices, and I didn't want that anymore. I wanted to try to be as selfless as I could, which is difficult just in general for all of us in the world. There's so much individual agenda anyways. We're taught to be that and do that.
Right.
But yeah, I really did try to let go of the other stuff. I mean, I had a bartend.
Yeah. So you couldn't let go of all of it, but I
no. Couldn't make money in LA as a yoga teacher at the time.
That's so true. Yeah. What year was that actually?
Oh my God, I have no idea. I was
not dating yourself.
Well, we're going to date me anyways on accident, but I was 21.
Okay.
And I'm not anymore. I'm on my mat now 30 years as of 2 weeks ago.
Oh man. Well, congratulations. That's a hell of a feat.
Thank you, man. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing. So let me talk a little bit about like Mati, because obviously she made a pretty huge impact on you. And so how did she, you know, differently than the, you know, LA fitness person, like infuse that spirituality? Was it because it was a different style, or was it because, you know, like you resonated with her more, or did she actually take the stuff that you were learning in that book and like infuse it into the teaching?
She did. I mean, there was so much talk about the eight limbs in class and just the depth of the practice and what, you know, she was asking us to do, which was really to go in Svadhyaya, right? You've got to go inside. You've got to look at yourself and start to see how you behave in the world and how you behave to yourself. And I mean, this was when, you know, not only had I been trying to adopt those concepts from the book, but now somebody else was speaking it out loud. And I felt like, okay, there are people actually teaching what's considered yoga. But then you get steeped in that community. And I was at Yoga Works in the 90s. So this is when everybody was there. I mean, this is one of the most exciting times to be at Yoga Works. And I, you know, I didn't know that when I was there. I was young and kind of fell into it. But, you know, this was Shiva Ray and Sean Korn and Hala Kuri and, oh my God, Annie Carpenter. So many amazing, I mean, Micheline Barry, like all of these people were coming in and out, you know. It was a fantastic time to be in that mix for sure. I really felt like I got the magical moment. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
And I was there 13 years. I, you know, Mati trained me. I trained very quickly after finding her. I feel like it was about 6 months, to be honest, maybe a year. But yeah, I mean, I was there for 13 years and just in the mix, driving from the Valley to Santa Monica every day.
How long of a commute was that?
Well, I learned how to take the really far canyons. So, but it was still far. You know, you could spend 3 hours in your car in LA to get 20 minutes away. So,
wow.
You never knew.
Yeah, that's crazy. And so when you got trained, I mean, did you start teaching right away?
I did. I was teaching right away. Yeah. But I wasn't teaching at Yoga Works. I was teaching at multiple other places in LA that would hire me straight out of the gate, basically. Because Yoga Works process is like mine with my training. Oh, my dogs are going to bark. It was like a 5-year process, and I wanted to put it into play. So I was teaching at multiple studios all over the city.
Gotcha. And were you teaching Ashtanga yoga, or what did she train you in?
So, no, we were trained in vinyasa, but alignment-based vinyasa. I mean, she really, it was really brilliant. She took the alignment of Iyengar and really did mix it with the fluidity of Ashtanga and vinyasa. And so what I truly do teach is alignment-based vinyasa. But in the process of that, we had to take from Chuck Miller, we had to take Ashtanga. So I was in the mix with Chuck. And back in the day, that was traditional Mysore, where you got tapped to stop and start and move on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was in Chuck's room the entire time I lived in LA. So, but Mati really wasn't teaching Ashtanga too much when I was there. She was teaching more vinyasa classes. Chuck really was my Ashtanga teacher.
And so what was the experience like going into your first Mysore class then?
Crazy.
Why?
I hated it. I hated Ashtanga.
Why?
I did. I felt like my life was so habitual and so patterned that I didn't want my practice to feel that way. But you have to think about that. I mean, I was a pretty young mind at the time. And when you're young, you think you know everything, right? That's what we do. And you know nothing. Now, as we get old-ish, I'm going to say, we freely admit we know nothing and we welcome the idea of definitely learning more. But it felt very static and like habitual to me. I'm in third series at this point. Ashtanga is my sole practice because yeah. I feel like it is the best teacher in realizing that same is never the same. You know, and no matter what we practice, we show up on the mat and it's so goddamn different every day, every day. And I've been through so much in my body and in my life that I have to show up on the mat humble and just present. And sometimes it's a complete, you know, it's a complete shit show. And other days it's beautiful and I feel light and like I'm not touching the floor.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about like some of the trials that you've kind of been through, because I know some of them, our listeners obviously do not. And yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, like what are some of the things that like kind of come in the way of you and your practice, or maybe even you and your life?
Life more than my practice. I mean, I don't think, I truly don't think I'd be alive without the practice or sane. So Matsi not only was my teacher, but became my friend, and she would come workshop and my teachers got exposure to her. And I had moved away, and it was, I think, the second year I was back in Michigan. I was 15 years on my mat at this time. So yeah, it was 2 years back in Michigan. And I started to feel funny. My pranayama practice was really labored. Things that physically would usually come very easily were becoming incredibly difficult, walking up and down the stairs. But at this point, I had a 2.5-year-old and a 14-month-old. So my exhaustion level, I felt, was pretty normal for chasing, right, having a brand new baby. Exactly. Yeah. Having a baby and chasing after a toddler. And my meditations got weird. You know, my meditations, I would always feel a lot of heat at the front of my neck and the side of my neck. And I was seeing visualizations of sickness and disease. You know, in hindsight, I think about a couple of things that I did. And it's so crazy when you look back and realize how we should always listen to our intuitive voice. And I've always trusted that piece of myself. But I don't think we listen as closely when it's about us. In 2000, I went to a lady, and we got an astrological reading. Anyways, a medium, basically. We went to speak to my stepdad who had passed away, and this was me and my sister. And all she kept talking about was, with me, was like sickness and alkalinity to acidity. And she kept going and going with this. And I was just getting pissed because I was the healthiest person I knew at that point. You know, I was practicing, I was vegetarian at that point, and yeah, I didn't listen at all. And, you know, diagnosed almost 4 years later, definitely 4 years later, I wish I would have paid attention. I wish I would have listened to that lady that I got so pissed at.
What were you diagnosed with?
So in 2004, I was diagnosed with papillary carcinoma, thyroid cancer, which, you know, it's really interesting because nobody should be allowed to say this to you, but I remember being told that this was if you're going to get cancer, this is the easiest cancer you can get. So, wow. Yeah, truly, that was said to me. So I'm 15 years in my yoga practice, and first of all, I'm not supposed to get cancer. What the hell, right? So, and you have to go through all of that because you look at those pieces and you say, but I'm doing everything right. What the hell? And now I'm looking at, you know, I have a 14-month-old and a 2.5-year-old, and now I'm sick. So diagnosis protocol is surgery. They remove whatever parts of the thyroid are diseased and then possibly parathyroids if they need to be removed. And then you get ablated, which is essentially RAI. It's radioactive iodine. It's this giant pill that they give you that radiates you. So I went in, I had my surgery. The surgery is pretty brutal. I mean, I've had 5 of these now, but it's, you get cut open ear, clavicle to clavicle. I mean, you're opened up.
Wow.
And you know, the risks, they always have to tell you the risks. And I had not yet been given 6 months. This was supposed to be a protocol surgery. So out of surgery, they do the ablation, which the story was hilarious because they put me in this room where the radiation is so thick that the guy comes in like this full beekeeper outfit. He's covered from head to toe. He's got a mask over his face, gloves, booties, the whole deal. And he hands me this giant pill with tongs. And I'm thinking, okay, first of all, you won't even touch this and I'm supposed to swallow it. But also, and second of all, what, I just had my neck sliced open and I'm supposed to swallow this giant pill? This is like a week after surgery.
Holy crap.
So I had to take this RAI and I was quarantined. My husband at the time had to build a door at the top of my stairs. My kids had to go stay with my mom. My animals had to be locked downstairs and I was quarantined by myself upstairs for a week because I was so radioactive that they made me buy a disposable cell phone. They told me to wear gloves all the time. They told me to throw out my sheets and my blankets.
Holy shit.
I had to flush the toilet.
It's like a scene from Chernobyl.
It's insane. I had to flush the toilet 3 times. But, you know, you start the process very yogically and you think, all right, I'm going to write songs and poetry and not turn on the TV and I'm going to meditate and there are 7 other limbs, right?
Right.
About 3 days in, I'm just pissed and I'm writing, like, my songs go from like inspired by Sarah McLachlan to, you know, inspired by Annie DeFranco, where I'm just writing angry songs and cursing everything and watching VH1 all day. But I survived it. I survived the quarantine and then went in for my scan and nothing had changed. So now began the process of figuring out what the hell was really going on. And it was about 12 weeks because they need you to completely heal and they really want to get a, you know, a scope of maybe the radioactive iodine didn't stick right away, but maybe it's going to. No, it didn't at all. So about 12 weeks, 14 weeks later, I was headed right back into my second surgery because it was still there and what they had taken wasn't enough. And no one could ever say, and they still can't say whether my cancer was recurrence or just residual. So second surgery.
It's really unbelievable. I mean, it's a.
Yeah. And I'm trying to stay positive, but I'm scared. I'm terrified. And, you know, Abina Vesa really became my nemesis because we love us. You know, I'm crying. Sorry. Yeah. We love who we are. We're like super, and we're trying to let go of that peace. But that's hard, man. When someone sits you down and with your family and says, you have 6 months and you have babies that wouldn't remember you because cognitive memories, what, start at 4. This is really difficult. And then to feel like I healed really well, I went back to teaching after like a week. My students were so amazing and so supportive.
I mean, you went back to teaching after a week after those 2 surgeries?
I did.
That's insane also.
Oh my God, I was stapled like Frankenstein. Well, and I was diagnosed in July and my studio was supposed to open in August of that year. And we did, we opened. I said, you know, whether I'm in the studio or not, it's gotta happen, it's gotta open. This, regardless of whether I'm here now, this becomes my legacy. So yeah, the studio opened on time and no, but my students were amazing. And, you know, I would tell really inappropriate jokes like about not being able to demonstrate Ustrasana because my head would pop off and roll around the room. Nobody really thought it was very funny, but one person. But I mean, you have to adopt a sense of humor as well, because what else are you going to do?
Well, you start realizing that life is so fragile that it's like you could either cry or you can laugh or
both.
And man, is yeah, or both, of course. That's a really difficult, those are really difficult things to do with your children.
Yeah.
And, you know, starting a yoga studio. And then, I mean, that's just a, It's a lot.
It was a lot. So my students were amazing, and I headed into second surgery. And second surgery, same thing. You know, I'm back to teaching. I'm stapled and super glued. And then 12, 14 weeks later, no change. Nothing's shifted. And at this point, we knew something had to change. I couldn't stay with the doctor I was with. The scope of what was going on was beyond where I was. So I had a really great contact that hooked me up with the chair of endocrinology at MD Anderson. And I traveled down to MD Anderson the first time and was finally diagnosed with metastatic resistant thyroid cancer. So metastatic into my lymph system. And resistant to the only cure, which was the radioactive iodine. So unless I went into clinical trials, which, you know, those are tricky anyways, because you never know if you're really getting it or getting placebo, my best option was surgery, and my body heals really well. I mean, if you were to look at me today, besides my voice, my Janis Joplin, which I got after first surgery, I'm not that much worse for the wear. You know, I'm still doing neurolumbus or Shasana, and I've had 5 neck dissections. So,
wow.
But yeah, this guy was amazing. And, you know, some frustrating pieces for sure in the mix of all of that, because basically what was happening was I was being what he called node plucked. So if you think of the lymph nodes like clusters of grapes, instead of cutting the whole stem and the whole cluster, my past surgeries, they were pulling one grape at a time. And so this is why they couldn't say whether it was recurrence or residual, because every time they plucked a grape, they could have very potentially, if the grape broke, could have been spreading my cancer.
Gotcha.
So I had my third surgery. Finally, we're on the right track. We're trying to get a handle on what's going on. Metastatic resistant thyroid cancer puts me in the 1% of survival with this cancer. So that was something else that I had to really try to wrap my head around, was how the hell am I going to do this? And this was when I really had to settle into, maybe I'm not going to be here. Maybe I'm not going to be here very long. And you know, you get your shit together. You get your will done, and you make sure your kids are taken care of. And
right.
So between my third and fourth surgeries, this is all true, by the way. I feel like I've lived like 19 lifetimes in a lifetime. Between my third and fourth surgeries, my little brother went missing. And I can't explain how unprepared we are to deal with this kind of fear and tragedy, because nobody teaches you where to put that. We don't, and it's impossible to figure out. We don't, it's not only so surreal, I don't know, there really aren't even words. It's hot and cold and slow and fast at the same time. It's horrifying.
Right.
After about 2 days of my brother being missing, both of my sisters, my mother, true, this is true, and I all had the same vision, dream, daydream, whatever you want to call it, because it was all at different times for each of us, where he showed us what happened to him. So we all knew that he was dead, but it took about a month and a half for them to really start truly looking and taking us seriously rather than him just leaving. I think there are a lot of problems with our, I'm going to say, quote unquote, justice system. Right. And, you know, I listen to a lot of these cases now and how much neglect happens when there really should be immediate response and there's not, because there are so many reasons why not to try to go find someone. So about a month, maybe a month and a half later, they found pieces of my brother. Yes, I said pieces. In bags in the Grand River. Still to this day, we only have, you know, parts. And then like every 5-10 years, something else resurfaces.
Wow. And how long ago was this?
You know what's so funny, Taylor, is I honestly don't know. I feel like it was 2006, maybe. I don't know. I don't hold on to dates that way. And I feel like so much was happening at once that I feel like it's such a blur. Like, I only know the date of one of my surgeries, the first one. And the only reason I know that is because it was like around the 4th of July because there were fireworks. I don't know when my surgeries were. I don't know the day he went missing. I don't know when they found. I don't know.
Wow. And so, like, what were the circumstances around, like, you know, your brother? Or, I mean, what did he show you, like, in those visions? Or what did he tell you in those visions that made you guys all kind of come to that same sort of conclusion? And
he showed us the whole thing. I mean, this is the honest truth. I was actually in Shavasana in one of my teacher's yoga classes, but my mom actually dreamed it. My sister saw it as she was awake in the middle of the day. He showed us him. First of all, he was locked in the trunk of his own car. And then he showed us him being let out of the trunk, running. They let him run, which is crazy, like hunted him. He was being chased through these woods. We all saw a yellow apartment building. He was running through the woods. Yeah, they had him kneel and he was shot execution style. And that really is what happened. I mean, we have his skull, his forearm, and like one calf. And he was shot in the head. What's so crazy too is when we spoke to each other, we all heard what he was saying. It was the same thing. I mean, it was really beautiful and really awful at the same time because I feel like we got closure right away. And when his case is still open, you know, it's still a cold case. So we would have, you know, we're not the kind of family. We're not an eye for an eye. I feel like I think I was an eye for an eye before this happened to my brother. And some people think that seems really backwards, but I just feel like violence breeds more violence. Doesn't make any sense to me. And I also don't know how families sit through the torture of seeing photos and my family is not this kind of family that's going to sit for months in a courtroom. I feel like at that point we all really got closure. And it's not that we weren't trying to follow up. We felt like FBI, the government should do their job. If they're going to find someone, they're going to find someone. I mean, I feel in my spirit that whoever did that was dead in 3 days themselves. So I'm a firm believer in karmic justice, whatever that means. And I don't feel that we as human beings have the right to put someone to death. I don't know. I think it's wrong.
I mean, it sounds like an extremely difficult, you know, however many years that was. But like, you know, as you came to that closure, I'm wondering, like, how did you reconnect with your yoga practice, like through the surgeries and obviously through the family tragedy with your brother? You know, how did you reconnect with your yoga practice? Like, did you stop practicing as a result of?
No, I was constant. I was in my practice almost every day. I mean,
even with the staples and super glue and head popping off and all of that stuff, like,
yeah.
Were you still in it?
Well, I waited my 12 weeks after each surgery to make sure that I was physically safe. Yeah. I was sitting. Man, was I sitting. Meditation, you know, this, I love asana, I do, but meditation is the most important piece. I really feel that our answers happen when we sit there patiently and wait for them. I don't think I would be sane. I honestly don't. I don't know how I would have processed any of this without my sits. No, it connected me closer to my practice because I feel like I had a way to vent. And once I hit my 12-week mark, I was on my mat. I mean, like I was crazy on my mat. You know, I avoided pigeon for like 6 months, but
yeah. Well, I mean, I'm also like wondering, you know, like so many people I've heard that have gone through serious tragedies, you know, like the ones that you're talking about right now, like turn away from their yoga practice instead of like going into it. So what made you like dial into it instead of, you know, like dropping
I needed my God, I needed my spirituality. I needed to know that, you know, my conversations with God at this point, I was mad and I was just, you know, I really was. I was having conversations with, I mean, I don't even know if I call it God, I don't know, but with my faith, I was having conversations where I was hashing it out. You know, I didn't understand. I was pissed off and I felt like I was getting answers in return. You know, what I would always encourage anyone to do, we need the mat the most when shit falls apart. When life goes sideways, get on your mat. Because if we have no way to process, if we have no way to vent, we get sicker and sicker and sadder, and that rabbit hole of depression. I mean, I know for myself, and I'm not prone to depression, but I know for myself that I was paralyzed and I could have stayed that way. That if I didn't get up and get moving, I wouldn't have. I mean, I was sat down twice and, you know, I was still headed into another two surgeries. And my fourth one was 3 years after. And then my fifth one was, I think, 2 years after that. So I was still trying to stay alive. You know, I'm in the 1% of survival and I just lost someone I literally saw be born. And I had a super close family. You know, there's that sutra that says practice without break and in all earnestness. Practice for a long time without break and in all earnestness. And that's just it, man. You get on your mat and you be as honest as you can be. But don't stop, because as soon as you stop, I feel like not only is it really hard to get motivated to get back on the mat, but I feel like you haven't been able to trickle it out. So what spills out then is almost uncontrollable, you know, overwhelming, this crazy mess. I don't know. I feel like yoga strengthens everything about who we are. And I mean, none of us get to corner the market on sadness or suffering. I mean, look at what you've been through. Look at what everyone you speak to has been through. We all bump into this shit. And yoga's been around for thousands and thousands of years because it says, just show up as you are. Because if you show up as you are, I'm going to help you. Breathe and be.
Yeah, I mean, I just see it so often that, you know, there's a breakup of a marriage or a breakup or even just of a boyfriend or, you know, a loss of a father or someone in their family. And then it's like the person disappears. And, you know, for me, like, that's not an option. You know, I don't really have that option. And it's like, I don't feel like I'm in jail because, you know, I have to be in this yoga thing. But I mean, there's some sort of like freedom that comes with like giving my body like a sense of movement and processing and sorting that a lot of times I feel like, and some people are scared of processing it too.
It's so true.
Interesting. Yeah.
You know, you're really honest on your mat though. I mean, that's the thing. I think that's the difference too, because, you know, I encourage my students to laugh out loud, to cry out loud, truly. And, you know, when I feel something's going on in the room, I walk around with a box of Kleenex and I'm like, you guys, this is the deal. There's no safer place to do this. If you need to cry like a baby, you know, I'm a firm believer that crying is the shower for the soul, that we need to be able to do that. But I also am really vocal about that as the teacher in the room. You know, if I need to process something, I practice with my students in my teacher's classrooms. And if I need to cry it out, I don't care if I'm the owner of the studio, I'm going to cry on my mat because it's my place to be. And sometimes I don't want to do that alone. Sometimes I want to know that I'm loved and cared for by the Sangha that I'm in the room with, because it's easier to do. You know, there's a lot of love and support in the room. I have in the past, though, when I've had students, because I really pride myself, and I know pride is an ego thing, but whatever, we all deal with it in different ways. I really pride myself on the fact that both of my studio spaces, our community loves each other, and we show up for each other. And if I have someone disappear for a significant amount of time, I really do touch base with them. And if they don't get back to me, I'm not going to show up at their house or anything. I have done that though, I'm not going to lie. I have, but we will reach out because I worry, you know, I've lost, and you have too. We lose our students, and that's one of the hardest thing in the world when they've been practicing and practicing, and then life takes them so sideways that they take their own lives. And that's really hard. Right. And if I can do anything to help avoid that happening, I'm going to try to do it. At the end of the day, if someone's really going to follow through, they're going to follow through. But I still, you know, I want all of my students to know that they are loved and cared for. I think it's really important.
I mean, I think it's really important too, you know, like my community over the last, like, you know, couple of years has obviously been through a lot of things, like, a little bit about some of that stuff. And we really, you know, one of the biggest things is like knowing that we love and support one another, even though that there's tragedy or there's harassment or hurt or whatever it is, that we're taking care of one another, because everyone's looking for their tribe, you know, everyone's looking for the people that they want to hang out with and, you know, spend their life with. It's like, you know, our friends are the family we get to choose. And some of us don't have great families. And so it's really nice to have a community that really like kind of supports and takes care of one another. And every time that I've been up to your place, I've really been amazed at how much like, you know, people know each other, how it is community, how people talk to one another, all of that stuff. So
it's sweet. It's sweet. I feel like it's really special. And you're right. Everyone does need to feel that. And what an amazing thing that we can offer that, especially to people who have really shitty families where there's abuse or molestation, whatever. You know, we do get to choose our families and we get to choose who we have in our lives. Just because karmically you're attached to a bio family doesn't mean you have to keep them.
Right. Yeah. And that's a hard thing for people to learn, actually.
It is.
Yeah. I mean, or maybe unlearn, I guess. Maybe that's a better way to put it. But I mean, totally. And so like as teachers or, you know, owners of businesses, because we have a lot of similarities.
Yeah, we do.
You know, like with our communities and, you know, businesses that we run and all that stuff, there's just a lot of similarities. But I mean, there's like this opportunity that we have to like each of the individuals to like to touch them on a different level.
Yes, you know? I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
And it's
so
amazing.
I'm wondering, like, you know, what is it like today, you know, like running your studios, coming to year 30 of your practice, going through all of the things that you've gone through? Like, what motivates you today to like get on your mat?
Everything.
Why do you do it?
I mean, first of all, this is going to sound really egoic and I hope I don't lose people when I say this, but I am so impressed and proud of this little body that I have that's been able to do this so many times and come back to the mat and have a crazy strong practice. I mean, I get on my mat some days and I learned right away that one of the only ways to heal when you have real illness is to accept it. That if you separate the pieces of your body that are sick and you say, this part of me is bad or this part of me is wrong, that healing cannot happen. And so my cancer and I, we really did end up just hanging out. And I have to be really honest with you. I was just cleared, which is amazing. I was cleared in April, finally in remission.
Wow. Congratulations. And
thank you. I was told I was never going to be in remission, but it was weird to almost hear that. I suffered. I grieved when I got cancer because I felt like all of those pictures of who you think you're going to be and how you think your life is going to go, you have to mourn the past, Hillary, right? But then even when my doctor told me I was cleared, I had this weird sense of loss. Like, oh shit, can I do this without my cancer? Do you know what I mean? Really?
Man, no, I don't know what you mean. But I understand what you said. And that's like pretty nuts because like that becomes like all of a sudden it's like, you don't know, man, that's like bundled up and wrapped perfect for me because like I think of that and it's like, man, it's sort of like my addiction.
Yes.
And it's like, I don't know if I could do this work without this thing. And so to not have this thing, because mine's a daily reprieve. Like I get to prolong my suffering if I do these these things, or I get to push off my suffering if I do these other things. And so I couldn't imagine like waking up one day and like healed.
Well, I mean, that's what's so crazy, right? So, but I get on my mat now and honestly, I feel like I'm a rock star. I feel like it's fucking amazing that I can still do Akapada Sirsasana without my neck giving out, or that I can, you know, all of it. I feel like I feel strong. I feel so empowered by this practice. And I don't know, I'm just trying to be present on my mat because, you know this, you were here. A month later, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. A month after I was cleared, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. It wasn't cancer, so thank God for that. Wow. But I did go into another surgery where they took out most of my girly parts, which is amazing because now I have no tubes, which means now I can't get pregnant. So bonus. I'm serious.
That's one way to look at it. Yeah.
I'm so serious. Yeah. But you know, I get on my mat now and it's not just my safe place. It's the place where I feel my power. It's the place where I feel like that rejuvenation to come back out into the world and be in two different states every week and run a studio that's been open 16 years, one that's been open three, these beautiful communities, like, and still teach 14 times a week, plus running trainings and apprentices. I'm insane. I'm an insane person. But the truth is, I'm starting to feel all of that in my schedule. So I'm honoring that. And I'm making moves to slow down a little bit. I'm writing my book. You and I were talking about that. Right. How's your second book going, by the way?
It's going a little slower than what I'd like, to be honest with you.
This is really hard. It's really hard to write a book.
I know.
It has to be way longer than what I've got.
It takes a long time, man.
Yeah.
Just to come up with the idea of how to like put it all down on a piece of paper is the hard part. Once you start writing, I feel like it kind of.
Yeah. I feel like the skeleton.
It's a little bit easier.
I feel like the outline is definitely the hardest part. But yeah, I am purposely making moves to slow down a little bit and possibly travel teach a bit. You know, I'm shifting. I feel like it's time for me to graduate a little bit.
That's good.
However that's going to play out.
Yeah. And you know, your yoga studio is like, you know, obviously like every time I've done a workshop, it seems like, you know, your yoga studios like are continue to stay busy. Like I had a great time in Lansing not too long ago and had a great time in Chicago not too long ago as well. And man, like it seems like, you know, because of the core knit group of people that are in both places, that it's just like, whether it's the teachers or students, gives you the opportunity to go off and, you know, do something else if you needed to.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I feel like I'm to that point where, you know, Lansing is sort of this well-oiled machine because it's so old. It's a 16-year space. And Chicago has had to spend a lot of time without me because I am back and forth. So my teachers have beautifully established themselves. You know, that's an interesting thing too, though, and you might feel this. You're like, aw. but don't you need me? Like,
yeah.
You know, but it's great.
When the community doesn't need you though, Hillary, that means like, honestly, that means you're doing a good job.
I know. You know? It's great.
Like, that means the people are trained, they bought in, they understand like what you're about, what the community means, like all of that stuff.
It's so perfect.
Yeah, I've had the same thing. I have like, I'm so lucky. I got three other authorized teachers and I get to basically like delegate, you know, work to them. And then I have this other group of teachers that are amazingly experienced.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of them teach a Mysore or intro classes, all this stuff. And it's just like this amazing, like, mesh of people that are just like, you know what? We just love this practice. We love this community and we want to share it with people.
Yeah, it's great.
It's freaking awesome. Yeah.
It's ideal. That's ideal. I mean, it's ideal for us to be able to walk away and have it still move.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
It's really awesome. Yeah. Well, you know, obviously we talked about a lot today.
We did.
I think there's probably, you know, there's probably like another hour that we could talk, but maybe we could do it again and where we could talk more about, you know, some of the yoga. But, you know, the Heartbreak Kids, like the reason why the whole podcast started was to like give people like a voice to like share their experience and share their hope and share their tragedies and all of this stuff. And I didn't know all of the stuff that you said today. And so I really appreciate you sharing it with the audience and, you know, all the listeners. And really, I mean, I'm grateful that you're in my life and I'm grateful for all of the support that you give me. And I'm grateful that, you know, over the last few years, we've got to get to know each other.
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, Hillary.
Thank you so much. Love to you and your family.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.